Monitor Monday is recorded before a live online audience. From the studios of Rack Monitor, this is Monitor Monday for April 15th, 2024. Here's today's rundown. Artificial intelligence is being heralded for examining many claims and instantly deciding their medical necessity. Providers expect the number of audits could double, triple, or even quadruple. But is AI as accurate as promised? From New York, Rack Monitor investigative reporter Edward M. Roche has our lead story. We will also hear from Kate Brantley, healthcare attorneys Mark Daniel and David Glazer, plus Dr. Ronald Hirsch. Now here's the publisher of Rack Monitor and the host of Monitor Monday, Chuck Buck.
Good morning, everybody, and welcome to Monitor Monday. We have a great deal of healthcare news reported, so we begin this morning, as we usually do, with Dr. Ronald Hirsch. He's making his Monday rounds here on Monitor Monday.
Monday Rounds is sponsored by R1 Physician Advisory Solutions. Here now making his Monday rounds is Dr. Ronald Hirsch.
Oh, good morning, all. Today I'm reporting from Coronado, California, the site of the National Physician Advisory Conference, joining 500 of my physician advisor colleagues for 4 days of nonstop education and networking, and sadly, very little time outside. Now, you can still register online if you want to attend. You'll be able to have a year to watch all the presentations, and you'll get the credits. So today, though, I have two topics. First, we've talked in the past about national and local coverage determinations, and I've complained how it's incomprehensible that the coverage for a procedure can vary amongst Medicare jurisdiction, with each MAC developing their own coverage determination. A physician advisor pointed out another nuance to this. His hospital started doing MRI-guided focused ultrasound surgery for treatment of essential tremor. Now, the procedure includes the word surgery, but there's no incision and there's no device use that goes in the body. In fact, the patient isn't even sedated for the procedure, so I don't know why they call it surgery. The device that's used is FDA approved, and the labeling requires that the physician performing the procedure be trained by the manufacturer in its use. But if you read the LCDs for this, two of the 8 MACs have a requirement for physicians who perform this to possess expertise and experience in functional and stereotactic neurosurgery. The other 6 have no such requirement. The problem is they took this requirement from a guideline from the American Society of Stereotactic and Functional Neurosurgery. Who knew that existed? And that guideline is not available to the public to know how it was developed, what literature they used. The society itself is all neurosurgeons. There's no board certification in stereotactic or functional neurosurgery, although there are some fellowships. So who really sets the qualifications? Now, this is not really surgery, and 6 of the 8 MACs have no specific requirements for the physician. So can a neurosurgeon who's properly trained by the manufacturer, like perhaps a neurologist who treats movement disorders every single day, perform this procedure? I would say yes, if the hospital determines the physician, by virtue of their training, now has, quote, expertise and experience, and they give that physician privileges. Now, what's the real message here? Well, before you start doing a new procedure or even spending money on the equipment, do your research on the coverage, the qualifications, and of course, the payment. Or your next $1 million purchase could be a really expensive doorstop, as almost happened to this hospital. Moving on, you've heard a lot how I hate key performance indicators that are not carefully considered. An example popped up last week. I was asked when billing observation hours starts. And of course, the answer is when the order for observation services is written. But this hospital's billing staff starts counting when the patient arrives in the observation bed. The problem, of course, is that they're undercounting and underbilling observation hours. And depending on how long it takes the patient to get to the observation bed, if they even get there at all, they may be losing out on the observation payment, even though that's pretty skimpy. But compared to other hospitals, I bet their observation hours per patient statistic, their KPI, looks absolutely fabulous compared to other hospitals. So making a KPI look good or getting paid more, which do you think is better? One more quick topic is Critical Access Hospital asked me what to do about Medicare Advantage patients who stuck in their facilities for days on end because no skilled nursing facilities in the area will accept MA patients, and the MA plan won't approve a swing bed. Well, my first suggestion was to find out how they're getting paid for the inpatient care from the MA plan. If they're paid by any other method other than DRG, and critical access hospitals often are, a long stay as an inpatient may pay pretty darn well, and keeping them an inpatient isn't so bad. But the bigger issue is that MA plans must have strict network adequacy standards, which includes SNF access within 1 hour in that county. So if the MA plan cannot provide a SNF bed, it seems the plan should be reported to Medicare for lack of network adequacy. And of course, another example of a lousy key performance indicator. Long length of stay is not a bad thing if you're getting paid more for every single day. Oh, and one last thing, the 2025 inpatient proposed rule came out, and it is boring for the UR world. Not one change to the two midnight rule. Now, they are proposing a big bundle payment program, but it's not going to start till 2026, so it's way too early to talk about it. Chuck, back to you.
Thank you, Dr. Hirsch. That was Vice President of R1 RCM on Hirsch MD, Dr. Hirsch, who's making his Monday rounds here on Monitor Monday. Here now with the Monitor Monday RAC report is Healthcare Attorney Bart Daniel. And Bart is substituting this morning for Nicole Emanuel. Good morning, Bart.
Good morning. As a former federal prosecutor, I handle results many times of RAC audits. And one of the things a RAC audit can lead to is the issuance of a civil investigative demand by a civil assistant U.S. attorney. Now, and that usually happens when an Office of Inspector General agent, a criminal agent or a civil agent, they're both the same, they investigate both cases, when the OIG agent or an FBI agent feels that they have some evidence that's worth investigating and opening a file or a case, they go to the assistant U.S. attorney and request a civil investigative demand. Now, a civil investigative demand is not a grand jury subpoena. That would be criminal. It is a civil investigative demand. However, it can be converted, can develop into a criminal investigation as well. So what is it? A CID or civil investigative demand is an administrative subpoena issued by the Department of Justice. It can be an assistant U.S. attorney, or it can be a Department of Justice lawyer with the fraud section in D.C. and District of Columbia. Usually remains civil. However, it's important to note that with every civil investigative demand that's issued by a civil assistant U.S. attorney, there's also assigned to monitor the case a criminal assistant U.S. attorney. And that is to see if the case, the information that's gathered from the civil investigative demand develops into a shows conduct, a potential criminal conduct, and then it converts into a criminal investigation. You may have both going at the same time. A civil False Claims Act investigation and a criminal investigation. So what should you do if you're served with a civil investigative demand? The first thing you want to do is do not ignore it. Do not bury your head in the sand. We have a saying that the federal penitentiary is full of ostriches. Those who have buried their head in sand and ignored the investigation or hope it comes out and concludes all right and nothing happens. Well, as we all know, hope is not a plan. So the first thing you want to do, the first step to take, is to retain a qualified white-collar lawyer. That doesn't necessarily mean you retain your normal regulatory lawyer. That regulatory lawyer that's advising you on healthcare matters may have experience responding to civil investigative demands, but he or she may not. And that is all the difference in the world. Because when you receive a civil investigative demand, there's very little, you know, when you see an attorney object right away to the issuance of a CID, then you know that lawyer, it's time for you to change. He or she does not know what they're doing, because there are very few grounds on which you can object to and have a civil investigative demand quashed or go away or dismissed, if you want to call it that. So the first thing you want to do is not ignore it. The second thing you want to do is retain a qualified attorney. And then number three, the attorney will help you do this. Put what's known as a legal hold or litigation hold on your records. That is electronic records and any paper records you may not have. And that simply means a legal hold. It simply means do not delete. From that point forward that you're served, do not delete. Even if you have a regular period of time within which your deletion policy runs, you suspend that that period, because you've got to maintain the sanctity and the documents you've got so that the government can investigate. And if you were, or someone in your organization begins deleting emails or other electronic data, or again hard copies, they could be investigated for obstruction of justice, which is a much more serious problem than responding to a civil investigative demand. Now, the fourth thing you want to do is note the date of production. Now, sometimes it's a very short date, a quick turnaround time, but your lawyer may negotiate a more reasonable period of time within which to produce the documents. Now, a civil investigative demand may require the production of documents, but it also may require for you or someone in your organization to sit down and give testimony to the civil assistant U.S. attorney. And that testimony is under oath. So if it's a particularly voluminous information that's requested, your attorney may negotiate what's known as a rolling production. That is, begin producing what you're able to retrieve and collate and collect right away. Or not right away, but within a very short period of time. And that demonstrates good faith. The defense counsel wants to demonstrate good faith throughout the process and a cooperation throughout the process. Why? Simply put, you've got no choice. And it's not the time for a lawyer to come in beating their chest or throwing nuclear bombs or shooting a flamethrower. Because once that hand grenade is thrown, it cannot be retrieved. And as I said, you're required to respond and submit to a civil investigative demand. Now, what does the lawyer do? What should the lawyer do? As a lawyer on the defense side, and I was a prosecutor on the government side, the best policy is to meet early and often with the civil investigative lawyer or the Department of Justice lawyer, whomever may be issuing the civil investigative demand. And the reason why you do that, and you want to make clear that your clients can cooperate, provide the necessary information, and is glad to comply with it. Now, you can get the production date extended for one thing. The other thing is, you want to know what's going on in the investigation as much as you can. I mean, you get this out of the blue, a civil investigative demand, and you say, what is this all about? Well, the assistant U.S. attorney will not talk to the person. It needs to be a lawyer, and hopefully it's a lawyer that is familiar with federal investigations, criminal and civil. So you want your counsel to develop a positive working relationship, because what you learn is a civil assistant U.S. attorney, as with a criminal assistant U.S. attorney or DOJ lawyer, they have broad discretion, and they can make your life miserable or they can make a difficult time go much more smoothly. And that's what you want. Now, after you produce, the government's in great hurry, and the OIG agent and the FBI agent, they want to get their hands on that information. They want to get that document so they can really put their teeth and begin an investigation. Now, you're wondering, okay, what's happens next? Well, unfortunately, while you're in the hurry-up mode because they're goading you into producing documents just as soon as you can, the government is not in any hurry. Many, many, many months may pass, a year, year and a half sometimes may pass before you hear anything back from the government. And that's why it's important that your counsel have an open line of communication with the assistant U.S. attorney, because it may be that the government goes in and based on one allegation, but as they're investigating, maybe your lawyer convinces the government that's not a legitimate, and maybe they disprove, your lawyer disproves that allegation. But we have a saying that once the camel gets his nose under the tent, they look all around the tent. They don't just limit themselves to the original allegation. Many times, and that's why counsel should be in regular, close communication with the assistant U.S. attorney. Because as investigations develop, different issues from time to time arise. And you want your counsel to be communicating so that they recognize what the issues are and that they go back to the client and see if they can disprove, the second issue that arises. And many times these investigations last a year and a half or 2 years, and sometimes they turn criminal. Now, when you turn criminal, I remember I said that an assistant U.S. attorney that's in the criminal division will monitor the case as it goes along. Well, when they discover, say, an email that's incriminating, and they discover a hard piece of evidence that looks to them to be criminal, then that assistant U.S. attorney in the criminal division also investigates the case. Now, usually the criminal investigator, the criminal assistant U.S. attorney, will defer for at least a while to the civil investigative attorney, the civil assistant U.S. attorney. And that's because they're getting the information as long as the client's providing information. But if it turns criminal, it may be that before long, the civil assistant U.S. attorney issues a federal criminal grand jury subpoena. Okay, the first thing you want to do if there's a criminal subpoena, which is to contact the assistant U.S. attorney and find out, is the client, is the healthcare provider a target or subject of this civil investigation or this criminal investigation? And you may be just that the client is a witness. The client has a repository of documents, or a client knows information or has information which may be about someone else who may be in violation. That's oftentimes the case. But the key is for the defense lawyer to get in early and often. Now, these civil investigative demands may be served even with no civil case on the docket. No civil case has been filed. It can be a preliminary to a civil case. And then if they get enough information, the assistant U.S. attorney believes is sufficient to warrant the filing of a False Claims Act case, then they file that case. But again, regular communication. Many times these cases are based on a misunderstanding, and your counsel can convince the assistant U.S. attorney to drop the case. Or an allegation arises, and maybe you decide to negotiate with the assistant U.S. attorney through your counsel. In any event, I cannot stress enough the importance of keeping the line of communication open. Now, it's significant to note that the assistant U.S. attorney that issues a CID is a civil attorney. However, the agent that has requested the CID, whether it's an FBI agent or an Office of Inspector General agent, they investigate both. There's not a second, with the U.S. Attorney's Office, a separate individual, a separate United States attorney comes into the case and may take the case over. But with an agent, it's the same agent or two agents or three agents that began the case with a civil investigative demand and requested that demand that also will investigate the criminal case and request many times a criminal prosecutor open an investigation.
Thanks, Bart, very much. That was healthcare attorney Bart Daniel. He was substituting the supporter for Nicole Emanuel. Bart is a partner in the law firm of Nelson Mullins. And coming up in about, let's say about 12 minutes after the hour in your time zone, we're going to hear from healthcare attorney David Glazer and Rack Monitor investigative reporter Edward Van Broach. Standing by to report our lead story, folks. It is Monday. It's April the 15th. You're listening to the live edition of Monitor Monday. Stand by.
The American College of Physician Advisors is the only physician-led nonprofit national association of thought leaders representing all aspects of the physician advisor role. Developed to expand the influence of physician advisors through education and industry networking, the membership consists of physician advisors and other hospital leaders focused on a broad range of topics, including utilization management, case management, clinical documentation integrity, regulatory compliance, revenue cycle, and executive leadership. Access uniquely formatted Medicare inpatient-only lists designed for ease of use. Results of the latest physician advisory survey, and take advantage of CME discounts available only to members. You're invited to partner with physician leaders and associated healthcare professionals and join in the effort to foster greater physician executive influence within healthcare systems. Click on the ad on the Rack Monitor homepage or go to acpadvisors.org to learn more.
Here now for the Monitor Monday Risky Business Report is healthcare attorney David Glazer. Good morning, David. David, what could be risky this morning?
Chuck, it's the risk that you will misunderstand when hospital privileges are required as a condition of reimbursement and when they're not. So today, I'm at the Healthcare Compliance Association's Annual Compliance Institute, giving one of my favorite talks. It addresses how to conduct legal research and how to recognize the difference between guidance, regulation, and statute. So one of the examples in the speech is how to react when a physician provides services to a hospitalized patient that exceed the scope of their hospital privileges. In one of those situations, that lack of privileges likely necessitates a refund. In the second, no refund is necessary. So what's the difference? Well, one of the challenges working in the healthcare compliance world is that there are many different regulatory schemes and different consequences associated with each violation. For example, Medicare has conditions of participation. When you fail to meet one, CMS will warn you and typically give you a number of days to correct the deficiency. The number of days varies with the severity of the violation. But conditions of participation are entirely independent of conditions of payment. People often struggle to recognize this distinction, and I've heard some insist that a refund is required when you provide a service that's inconsistent with any Medicare policy, including the conditions of participation. But there is clear proof that this is wrong. Section 3.1 of the Medicare Program Integrity Manual includes this paragraph. MACs, Medicare Administrative Contractors, CERTs, compliance education, I don't know, I can never remember the CERT, and recovery auditor staff shall not expend Medicare Integrity Program, or MIP, resources analyzing provider compliance with Medicare rules that do not affect Medicare payment. Examples of such rules include violations of the conditions of participation, COPs, or coverage or coding errors that do not change the Medicare payment amount. That language makes it abundantly clear that you can be out of compliance with the conditions of participation without having an overpayment. It's the condition of participation that imposes the general duty on hospitals to make sure that their physicians are properly privileged. So generally, lack of privileges won't create an overpayment. But there is a notable exception. The two-midnight rule, found at 42 CFR 412.3, defines as inpatient as a person formally admitted as an inpatient, with Section B of that rule saying the order must be furnished by a qualified and licensed practitioner who has admitting privileges at the hospital, as permitted by state law, and who's knowledgeable about the patient's hospital course, medical plan of care, and current condition. So under that regulation, for someone to be an inpatient, there needs to be an order, and that order must be from a professional with privileges. I will note it didn't say written, just as an order, but that's another episode. So the bottom line is that a physician performing a surgery for which they lack privileges and a physician admitting a patient without admitting privileges are analyzed differently. If a physician performs a surgery for which she lacks privileges, you fix it and move on. But if she admits a patient when she lacks admitting privileges, in most cases, a refund will prove appropriate. So Chuck, speaking of fixing, the fix sings that one thing leads to another. And while that may often be true, I will state your case in black or white. A lack of privileges will lead to one thing, but that one thing often won't be a refund. Back to you.
Thanks, David, very much. That was healthcare attorney David Glazer. David is shareholder in the law firm of Frederickson & Byron in downtown Minneapolis.
Maintaining strict regulatory compliance continues to be a challenge. A variety of factors, including the deluge of regulatory news, make it feel like you're navigating turbulent waters. Now more than ever, you need to be sure everyone on your team, including those who work remotely, is following the same guidance and moving in the same direction. A subscription to Rack Monitor Compliance Webcast is your port in the storm. For a single money-saving fee, your entire team can access the full library of exclusive Rack Monitor educational webcasts featuring nationally acclaimed compliance and audit experts. Register at the Rack University Bookstore today. The legislative update is sponsored by Zealous. Zealous is modernizing the healthcare financial experience by bridging the gaps and aligning interests across payers, providers, and healthcare consumers.
Here now with the Monitor Monday legislative update is Kate Brantley.
So listeners are surely aware that the healthcare industry has witnessed a burgeoning integration of artificial intelligence technologies, promising things like improved diagnostics, reduced administrative burden, and safer patient care. However, this rapid advancement has also prompted concerns regarding, naturally, ethics, privacy, and safety. Recognizing these challenges, the federal government has initiated multiple efforts to regulate AI in healthcare. And while none apply directly to commercial health plans or hospitals just yet, the government's focus could be a harbinger of what to expect in those areas. And the name of the game for the federal government so far is mitigating risk. Last week, the White House Office of Management and Budget, or OMB, issued its first government-wide policy on AI. Applying to federal agencies, the new OMB policy primarily looks at risks directly caused by an agency's use of AI products. It requires each agency to designate a chief AI officer and publicly post a plan to comply with a policy that's updated each year. It also requires strengthening IT infrastructure and updating cybersecurity, openly sharing developed AI code and models, as well as training data, and conducting an AI impact assessment that IDs potential risks versus the benefit of using AI in whatever action the agency is taking, including if the AI is using data from a federally protected class. HHS's Office of the National Coordinator for Health IT released their draft 2024 to 2030 Federal Health IT Strategic Plan and again highlighted the risks that could be caused by the use of AI in healthcare, prioritizing a, quote, culture of privacy and security to protect data from misuse. With Congress's focus on this risk so far, about 20 states have at least proposed taking on the responsibility of regulating AI more broadly within their borders. These bills typically look at topics such as data privacy, transparency around when an AI system is being used, protection from AI system discrimination and bias, and accountability on those developing and utilizing AI systems. The number of states proposing these bills is only expected to grow. But we've all heard that AI is already being utilized in healthcare. So let's take a look at an emerging name in the industry that hopes to take the reins. A somewhat new group called the Coalition for Health AI, or CHAI, is hoping to become the, quote, trusted source and curator of best practices of AI in health. Members of this coalition include tens of hospitals and health systems, as well as larger partners like Amazon, CVS Health, and Google. The coalition has drafted a, quote, blueprint for trustworthy AI implementation for healthcare and recently announced its plans to collaborate with the National Health Council and HL7 to work on a framework for AI in healthcare settings. Chai has been acknowledged by several government agencies, indicating the potential for a public-private partnership. So, Chuck, there's been a question floating around about who will take the lead in the race to regulate AI, and so far, it's anyone's game. While the federal government and states have certainly been busy, the fact that AI is already being utilized in healthcare indicates that this industry might be moving faster. It remains to be seen if this pops up on the campaign trail this year, but we'll keep you updated, Chuck. Back to you.
Thanks, Kate, very much. That was Kate Brantley. Kate is a senior government affairs liaison for Zealous. As you heard us mention at the top of the broadcast, artificial intelligence, AI, is being heralded for its ability to review hundreds and hundreds of claims, and subsequently, providers can expect a deluge of audits. So, Ed, you've been reporting on AI for a long time. Can providers really defend themselves against AI audits?
Not yet. AI is being applied in Medicare auditing. It can greatly increase the number of claims analyzed and increase the speed of auditing and supposedly reduce costs. AI likely will be used as a supplementary tool. It will generate initial audit results, then a human will review and sign off on the work. Problems. Research has shown that paraprofessional auditors lack specific expertise and credentials to conduct data-driven audits, apply judgment and deference to technology, and disregard the impact of AI-driven decisions on the public interest. It is widely recognized that AI auditing systems can be faulty. Many have argued that systems dependent on AI and machine learning need to be certified as being lawful, ethical, secure, and reliable. Some have called for creating an international regulatory agency to handle the legal and ethical issues of AI. Others have proposed our government set up an agency that will certify the safety of these systems. Nevertheless, at this time, there is no clear and universally accepted methodology to evaluate AI in the healthcare setting. There are no standards and no authorities empowered to perform the certification. AI systems can generate an unintended bias in healthcare. They can inadvertently learn to make poor decisions, systematically adverse for some groups. Clinicians are affected by automation bias, a tendency to over-rely on automation. According to one paper, statistical analysis tools utilized in fraud inspection processes prescribed by the U.S. government are deployed to justify abuse of power via auditor enforcement actions. These are used against healthcare providers in a fashion that stifles their financial viability and shifts power towards larger, albeit not necessarily more effective or efficient actors. In any case, Chuck, a few AI audit defense themes are emerging. Number one, certification. There are no standards in place for determining whether or not the results of these algorithms are valid. It is impossible, therefore, for the courts to determine, even using outside experts, whether or not a particular algorithm is reliable. Number two, charter violation. The system of auditing present in the United States is based on the use of subcontractors operating as agents for the government. These human auditors have acquired certifications in order to get their jobs. If humans are no longer doing the auditing, then the company's work is invalid. That is, it's being done with no certification, unless the contracts are renegotiated and the enabling legislation or administrative law is changed. Number three, constitutionality. It is impossible to understand the factors that were considered and the underlying reasoning behind any AI decision. It is impossible to have a hearing under administrative law in which the so-called auditor can provide further explanation. If the accuser is an undecipherable algorithm, then how can anyone, including the trier of fact, truly understand what has happened? How can the Sixth Amendment be complied with? Number four, scientific validity. Even if the work of the AI algorithm appears at first to be logical and reasonable, it is impossible to dig into the details and understand exactly how the conclusions were derived or replicate the work. Bottom line, AI does not pass the test for scientific reliability, at least according to the federal rules of evidence. Back to you, Chuck.
Thanks, Ed, very much. That was Rack Monitor investigator reporter Ed Roach calling in from New York. And folks, that is going to be a wrap for this live edition of Monitor Monday. We thank you very much for being with us. Special thanks to Bart Daniel, who substituted this morning for Nicole Emanuel, David Glazer, Ronald Hirsch. As you heard us mention at the top of the broadcast, artificial intelligence, AI, is being heralded for its ability to review hundreds and hundreds of claims, and subsequently, providers can expect a deluge of audits. So, Ed, you've been reporting on AI for a long time. Can providers really defend themselves against AI audits?
Not yet. AI is being applied in Medicare auditing. It can greatly increase the number of claims analyzed and increase the speed of auditing and supposedly reduce cost. AI likely will be used as a supplementary tool. It will generate initial audit results, then a human will review and sign off on the work. Problems. Research has shown that paraprofessional auditors lack specific expertise and credentials to conduct data-driven audits, apply judgment and deference to technology, and disregard the impact of AI-driven decisions on the public interest. It is widely recognized that AI auditing systems can be faulty. Many have argued that systems dependent on AI and machine learning need to be certified as being lawful, ethical, secure, and reliable. Some have called for creating an international regulatory agency to handle the legal and ethical issues of AI. Others have proposed our government set up an agency that will certify the safety of these systems. Nevertheless, at this time, there is no clear and universally accepted methodology to evaluate AI in the healthcare setting. There are no standards and no authorities empowered to perform the certification. AI systems can generate an unintended bias in healthcare. They can inadvertently learn to make poor decisions, systematically adverse for some groups. Clinicians are affected by automation bias, a tendency to over-rely on automation. According to one paper, statistical analysis tools utilized in fraud inspection processes prescribed by the U.S. government are deployed to justify abuse of power via auditor enforcement actions. These are used against healthcare providers in a fashion that stifles their financial viability and shifts power towards larger, albeit not necessarily more effective or efficient actors. In any case, Chuck, a few AI audit defense themes are emerging. Number one, certification. There are no standards in place for determining whether or not the results of these algorithms are valid. It is impossible, therefore, for the courts to determine, even using outside experts, whether or not a particular algorithm is reliable. Number two, charter violation. The system of auditing present in the United States is based on the use of subcontractors operating as agents for the government. These human auditors have acquired certifications in order to get their jobs. If humans are no longer doing the auditing, then the company's work is invalid. That is, it's being done with no certification, unless the contracts are renegotiated and the enabling legislation or administrative law is changed. Number three, constitutionality. It is impossible to understand the factors that were considered and the underlying reasoning behind any AI decision. It is impossible to have a hearing under administrative law in which the so-called auditor can provide further explanation. If the accuser is an undecipherable algorithm, then how can anyone, including the trier of fact, truly understand what has happened? How can the Sixth Amendment be complied with? Number four, scientific validity. Even if the work of the AI algorithm appears at first to be logical and reasonable, it is impossible to dig into the details and understand exactly how the conclusions were derived or replicate the work. Bottom line, AI does not pass the test for scientific reliability, at least according to the federal rules of evidence. Back to you, Chuck.
Thanks, Ed, very much. That was Rack Monitor investigator reporter Ed Roach calling in from New York. And folks, that is going to be a wrap for this live edition of Monitor Monday. We thank you very much for being with us. Special thanks to Bart Daniel, who substituted this morning for Nicole Emanuel, David Glazer, Dr. Ron Lewis, and Rack Modern investigative reporter Ed Roach, who reported our lead story. And one more thing before we go, folks. Join me tomorrow on Talk 10 Tuesday. That's when you're going to learn how to streamline patient access. Until tomorrow, I'm Chuck Quack, reporting for Rack Monitor and Monitor Monday. Have a great week, everybody.
Monitor Monday is a presentation of Rack Monitor.